You're listening to Razor Riffs with Keith Razor and Alan Lee, right here on LA Talk Radio.
All right, excellent. Are the speakers on? Sweet. Welcome to the show, guys. They found a little funky. Alan Lee's not going to be here today. He had work or something, but I wanted to plug some dates real fast, and then I'll introduce the guest. This Saturday, I'm going to be at the Hollywood Improv with Jay Moore, and then Friday, January 3rd, the Rec Room with Tom Rhodes, and January the 7th, I'm headlining the Irvine Improv. So come out, buy your tickets, and support us. And then my guest today, who really came out through for me, I've been trying to get him for a while, is Guy Tori. How are you, guys?
What's going on, man?
Good, man. How are you?
I'm good. I'm on break right now, man. Yeah. Off the road anyway. Not break as in not doing stand-up, but break as in I don't have any road shows.
So. Yeah.
I usually don't work December, so you got me. You got me, man.
We were supposed to have you when you were doing Ontario, and I had a plan because I was going to be like, oh, I'm going to be really, really funny, and Guy's going to be like, hey, you want to open for me Ontario? I'm going to be like, yes.
It wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
I have my openers. It could have been a possibility, though, because I didn't have my normal opener in Ontario. She, young lady, Miss Pretty Ricky, she booked a cruise, and it was definitely paying more than what, you know, the improvs pay openers. So I told her to take that gig.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had some good openers, some good replacements. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just saying, like, that's just my dream, you know, just to do stand, because, like, I'm one of those guys where, like, I just love doing comedy no matter what, you know what I mean?
Do you travel a lot?
I travel with Jay Moore, and I used to travel with Norm Macdonald.
And you still love it?
Yeah, I love it. So, I mean.
I tell people all the time, if the jokes are free, it's the traveling that you're paying for.
Yeah.
You're paying us to leave out of our homes and our comfort of our own beds and our own toilets.
Yeah.
And to get on planes and deal with nasty-ass TSA and those airplanes and hotel beds. And that's what you're paying for. The jokes are free.
Yeah. I heard, like, because.
Can I cuss on here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Another line.
I heard because, like, I go to school, too, and then one of my.
What are you studying?
Screenwriting.
Okay.
Good. So,
don't forget me.
Yeah. I wrote, like, 4 movies. If I sell any, you're in them.
If?
I'm trying.
When?
Oh, when?
See? That's a good word. You'll never sell anything saying if. Well, I hope.
Yeah.
Those words are setups for you to fail. So you can say, well, I tried.
Oh, okay.
No.
That's actually good advice.
When you sell your screenplay, words have power, man. I say this all the time. Change your language, change your life, change your words, you change your world. So just, you know, you got to see it, man. You got to believe in yourself. Otherwise, nobody else going to believe in your ass.
That's true. Okay, so when I sell them, you're in.
All right. Yeah. You heard it here.
Yeah.
I'll come find you. I got a crew. we'll find you, brother.
Yeah. But in one of my classes, this girl was doing a lecture because her mom works at Southwest, and she said that, like, if you...
Southwest Airlines? Okay.
Yeah.
You got a buddy pass?
No. Oh. I don't really know her. But she was saying how, like, if you wanted to, like, upgrade to first class, you know, you just got to be nice to the ticket people, maybe give them chocolate or something. So I went to San Jose this week, and I tried that. It's fucking bullshit.
Well, first of all, you can't upgrade on Southwest.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Damn. You fell for the banana in a tailpipe, man.
Yeah, so he gave the ticket guy some chocolate, fucking and he's rookie. Looking at me like I'm weird. I'm like,
he thought you shot a hit on him.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I have Asperger's syndrome, so I believe everybody. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm so gullible, and I'm just like, oh, whatever.
Man, yeah, you gotta do something about that real soon, especially in this damn industry.
Yeah.
Come on, man.
That's true. But when I first started doing comedy, this was probably 2005, 2006, you were doing the Tuesday nights at the Comedy Store.
Oh, Fat Tuesdays, yeah. The hottest night in the country.
Yeah. And you brought in a lot of big names like Tucker.
Well, I didn't bring them in. They just wanted to play the club. I mean, it was simple. I had really no – this is really pre-social media, I didn't have any radio budget or anything, man. I just built a brand, man, that when you came to Fat Tuesdays, you knew you were getting, you know, a great show.
Yeah.
And you never knew who was going to – I never advertised who was going to be there.
Yeah.
I just advertised the night. But it was so many great comedians that were falling through and getting on stage, and the women were beautiful and sexy, and, you know, the guys want to come out and see the beautiful women, sexy ladies. So it was always packed. And then the celebrities came out, you know, yeah. everybody from Prince to Denzel to you name it, to Quentin Tarantino to, you know, a lot of comedians were discovered at that night. So it was a really, really hot night. It wasn't like me being the funniest and people wanted to see me. It was just like I caught lightning in a bottle, man. And it was just, everything was connected. Everything was right, man.
And you worked your ass off, too.
I was work. When you run a room, because, you run a room, it's work.
It's
a lot of work. And you know, I got in fights and arguments with my agents all the time about, you know, it's taken away from me and being an artist and being a stand-up. But my whole thing was trying to put other comedians on.
Right.
So it was like, okay, if I have to, give up a little bit of my stardom to build other stars, then I think more stars are better than just one star shining. So
when you stopped the Tuesdays, like, what made you want to stop that? Just you wanted to...
It was just a lot of work, man. At the time, I was just got married, so I was a newlywed. That's a lot of fucking work.
Yeah.
I was still touring at the same time, so, and I was still acting, still doing movies and TV.
Yeah.
And running a room. That's four really full-time jobs right there.
Yeah.
So something had to go. And since that one was the least profitable one, outside the marriage, because that wasn't really profitable, but not for me anyway, then the Fat Tuesdays was the one that I felt had to go. But I made sure it was I left it in good hands.
Was this marriage the one where you proposed on the Tonight Show?
Yeah.
How, like, what was that like?
It was dope. It was a dope experience, man. I still say my wedding day is the most beautiful day of my life.
Yeah.
And you know, it was really, I was promoting, The Animal and Pearl Harbor came out a week apart.
Yeah.
So I was promoting those two movies on the show. And, you know, I had been dating my girlfriend long distance, you know, for about 3 years, about 2.5, close to 3 years. And then I basically, women kind of give you an ultimatum or don't give you an ultimatum, but it's really an ultimatum.
I don't know.
You will. They'll throw hints and say little things. So I was like, you know what? You know, why not? And I wanted to do it big and make a splash. So I chose to do it on the Tonight Show. Plus, I had a lot of women around the country to tell at one time that I'm off the market.
Yeah.
I can't remember all these bitches I fucked.
That's got to be like, that's like the most romantic proposal ever, though, right?
It was crazy. A lot of guys got mad at me because their girlfriends were looking at them like, then you know, damn it, why didn't you see what he did? Guy getting married. So, yeah.
I see comedians trying to do it at comedy clubs and like...
Whenever... I've done it.
Oh,
not comedians, but I've been the comedian on stage when people have asked me, you know, the manager comes to you and say, hey, this guy wants to propose to his wife, during the show. I said, well, after the show, we're not doing a damn show. But yeah.
But yeah, like I've seen like actual comedians, you know, like
really?
Guys like they like, oh, so I've been with my girlfriend for 13 days or whatever. And then like they make it a joke, like proposing. And it's just like, I always thought it'd be funny if she said no.
You see, I knew my ex was going to say, she's my ex now.
Yeah.
I knew she was going to say yes because she had, you know, she had did that ultimatum thing. So
yeah.
I wasn't worried about her saying no.
It wouldn't have been funny if she said no to you, but I'm saying at a comedy club.
Yeah.
It would have been funny because it's like, it just embarrasses the comedian.
Hell yeah. That's funny.
Live TV, it's different.
I never thought about that though. Comedians actually do it. That's really funny.
Yeah. So, but, and then you brought in Chris Tucker and Michael Blackson and all those guys.
Oh yeah, Fat Tuesdays, man. Fat Tuesdays had everybody, man. Coming in from Chappelle to you know, Chris Tucker, Chris Rock has dropped in there. My brother Joe Torre, I mean, Pauly Shore, Dice Clay. They've all graced that stage. Kevin Hart, Cat Williams. I mean, it was just a few. Mike Epps, Cedric the Entertainer. You know, Bernie Mac.
Yeah,
they all would come through, man, and on the strength. And it was just that hot night, man. That was, that was so incredible.
Well, how does that, like, make you feel about, like, all these great comics where, you know, you didn't necessarily discover them, but you gave them a spot on your show?
I didn't discover anybody, man. Yeah. I gave them a platform. Nick Cannon was actually discovered at Fat Tuesdays.
Everyone should leave him alone right now.
Hey, Nick Cannon's a good guy, man. Eminem beef.
Yeah.
But no, man, it's you know, it's just, there's tons of clubs around this city, around this country.
Yeah.
And I just had a platform to showcase, so I can't take credit for discovering anybody.
Yeah.
I can only take credit for providing a platform where they showcase, because I didn't write any of their jokes. I didn't make any phone calls on their behalf or set up any meetings. So what they did was all them. I mean, I was just really trying to showcase them because, you know, industry quit going to the hood to see black comedians. And I wanted to showcase all the talent that was coming out of the hood or performing in the hood. So, yeah, it's all the credit. And I can't take any of it, man.
Well, have you ever gotten jealous where, like, someone got offered something on your show that you're like, ah, fuck,
no.
How come they didn't
No,
ask
because
me?
What's mine is mine, what's theirs is theirs.
Yeah.
I mean, there's tons of comics who started either before me or with me and have gone on to reach a lot of success,
yeah.
Some more so than mine, but that's theirs. That's not mine. I can't get mad at that.
Yeah.
Because if you get mad at that, if you take credit for someone.
You get bitterness.
But if you take credit for someone blowing up, like, oh, I did that, then if a comic went on stage and bombed and slit his wrist or her wrist after that show that they bombed, you going to take credit for that? For the death? No. So if you can't take credit for the highs, then or the lows, don't take credit for the highs either.
Yeah. That's true. I never thought of it like that.
Yeah, because with comics, you know, and comedians, we're very selfish, narcissistic, fucked up individuals, and it's you know, you have to balance and fight that darkness.
Yeah,
you know, to live a normal life for balance, basically.
I've noticed that there's only like anyone can go on stage and tell a joke, but only certain people can go on stage and keep doing it. You know, that's why, like,
yeah, some, crazy people,
yeah,
so, like us.
Some comics do it for like 2 years and then they're done,
right? Because they tried it out. It wasn't for them. Because it looks easy. We make it look easy.
Yeah,
we make it look like we're just on stage, being a silly ass or being an asshole with jokes, and we make it look easy. So like, oh, I can try this. I'm funny at the office. I'm funny around my family. I'm funny around my friends. And they get on stage and they die the death of 1,000 dogs. But, you know, hey, they tried.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that you got to love it. It's got to be here in your heart. Because if it's not, man, you know, this game is no game. Comedy is no joke.
Yeah, that's true. You strike me as a type of comic where...
I'm a comedian, by the way, actually.
Yeah.
Comic says funny things. A comedian makes things funny. There you go.
Oh, that's... Okay, you strike me as a type of comedian who writes on stage. Like, you
both?
Just go... Yeah.
I'm a big prep guy. I got to do prep.
Yeah.
I'm you're more confident. It depends on who you are. Not everybody. Some comics can go on stage and just wing it.
Yeah.
I can, but I don't like to.
Yeah.
I rather write my shit down word for word.
Yeah.
And, you know, because I'm a writer, too. So I write it down, and then I just put bullet points, and then I go on stage and have it there. And I'll try to, like, you know, well, I try. Because I don't try anything. So what I'll do is I'll incorporate both, because you got to read the audience.
Yeah.
You know, you can have your set plan, which is great. Some comedians can stick to it. But you can have this set plan of what you want to do. But if the audience ain't feeling that, you gotta be able to Omaha out of that bitch.
Yeah.
You know, you gotta audible and go to another play and go to some, you know, something else. So it's good to be structured, but it's also good to be loose. But it's good to find that balance between being structured and also being able to freestyle.
Now, what is your advice on how to, like, gain that skill? Like, really... Just keep,
which one?
Just getting to read the audiences and freestyling if you need to.
Stage time.
Just go up.
Stage time. The more reps you get, the more comfortable you get on stage. But I always say hosting.
Oh, yeah.
Hosting takes the pressure off you to be funny. Still be funny, you know, because the show isn't about you. It's about the entire show. It's about everybody on that show. You're the first person they see. You're damn the most important part of the show because you're taking all the bullets first. And you got to be able to withstand those bullets. And bring the audience to a level to where, you know, they're ready and warmed up for the first comic coming on after you, or comedian coming on after you. So, but the more you host, the more comfortable you get on stage, and the more you'll be able to read audiences.
Yeah.
So then when you start featuring and headlining, then it's just second nature by that time.
When I started, I would always do anything to host, you know what I mean? Because that was the hardest thing for me, because I can't read people.
And but you're a good host. Everybody's not a host. Just because you're funny doesn't mean you're a host. Hosts have to be not high energy, but some energy, because you're the first person they see. You set the tone.
Yeah.
And you want to be funny, and you want to be kind of like, you know, you want to sell the crowd in. It's like it's like, hey, welcome, you know, to our house. And so everybody, you know, some hosts go straight in, go on stage, go straight to the material.
Yeah, I'm probably one of those hosts. Like, yeah. I just go. So,
there's a little bit of a greeting.
Yeah. So, you know, no, I say, like, hey, welcome and all that stuff, and then I just go straight into it because I don't know, because I, like, my comedy heroes, they, you know, everyone I always ask, and I've interviewed a lot of people, they say just go straight to the jokes and just, you know, make people laugh. Like, that's the most important thing.
Yeah, I mean, but I mean, what I mean, yes, true.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that first minute.
Yeah.
You know, that first minute, at least let them, you know, get them warmed up, get them settled in. Yeah. You know, like, oh, the show has started.
Yeah,
like, and then go into your material.
Like, Fraser Smith, I think, is the best host. Yes.
You know, he's a great host.
He just goes up and, you know, he sets it in. But I, to answer your question, no, I don't think I'm a great host. I think I'm an okay host. Like, I could do it if I need to.
Right.
But when Norm promoted me to feature.
Norm is funny.
Yeah. And he's the best, isn't he?
He's one of the funniest, man.
Yeah. And, you know, he would always say, you know, just do your best because you're never going to be funnier than me. And, like, that taught me to get, you know what I mean?
Right. I'll show him.
Yeah.
He can't follow me.
And I think out of the 300 shows I've done with him, maybe I matched him once, if that.
He didn't match.
So, like, that's just, well, that's what I'm saying. If that, so I'm telling you, like, the batting averages.
Right.
You know, when you're touring.
But it's not your job to match.
Yeah.
It's your job to be funny and get to set the table for Norm.
Yeah.
That's it. I was the first host of the Kings of Comedy Tour.
Yeah.
Right? I was 5 years in the game. Those guys were already 15, you know, plus years in. And I was still, that's when I was a comic. I was a comic back then. I didn't have an act. I had jokes, but I didn't have an act. And, but I knew it wasn't about me.
Yeah.
Right? But I knew I had to, you know, kick ass while I was on stage. And that's the balance, again, with that balance stuff. It's like, you got to be able to make your mark because they're not there to see you.
Yeah,
they were there to see Bernie, Cedric, and Steve because DL hadn't joined the tour yet. DL didn't join the tour until I left, DL Hughley. Yeah. So, So the thing about it was I had to, you know, make sure I got the crowd there, but at the same time, not step on their toes.
Because
I would listen to their set. And if I had any jokes that were close to their jokes, I would take them out my act.
Yeah.
Because I wanted it fresh for them. I had enough material to be able to do that, to take, you know, whatever jokes I had similar to those guys out and do it in set, but still get the audience where they need to be.
Right.
Because they're there for them. They weren't there for me.
Yeah. When your brother is a comic too.
Joe Torre.
Yeah, Joe Torre. Does that, when you were a young comic, did that, like, help you become better? Like,
absolutely. On several levels. One, he inspired me to do stand-up just by him doing it. He was one of the, you know, pioneers of the Def Comedy Jam.
Yeah.
You know, he and Martin Lawrence were the ones who really inspired me, you know, at that age. But, you know, my brother allowed me to live with him, you know, rent-free.
Oh.
For, you know, what I think the 4 or 5 years when I got out of here. And for those of you know, when you move to L.A.,
It's tough. Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't have to sleep in my car or sleep on somebody's couch. I had my own bedroom, you know, I had my own car. And that pressure, he was already making money. So he just said, as long as you're on stage working on your craft, don't worry about paying any bills.
Yeah.
And I made sure I was on stage 2 or 3 times a night, 7 days a week, or at least 6 days a week, grinding. And he saw how serious I was. And after 2 years of doing stand-up, I did Def Comedy Jam.
Yeah.
But that's because I got so many reps in.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like do one show a week or 2 shows a week. No, I was grinding, hitting spots after spots, holding the wall, pizza joints, hosting when I can, jazz shows, art shows. It didn't matter. College shows. Didn't matter. I wanted a stage, a mic, I had my pen and my pad, and my little voice recorder, and I was going to town. And putting in that work, you know, man, putting that work paid off.
Yeah.
And so when he saw that, you know, that allowed me not to be stressed out and have to worry about. I mean, although I did work a job. I worked as a marketing assistant on a movie called Zebrahead, an Oliver Stone film. And I also worked as a PA on the Martin Show.
Oh, nice.
So yeah.
Yeah.
And I did extra work too. I did background work.
Oh, really? Like, what was that like?
It was fun because, you know, every job you get in this industry, you should learn. It's good because it's almost like a paid intern.
Yeah.
Because you can learn the different aspects. Like when I was an extra, I learned how to act on set.
Yeah.
I didn't take any acting class or anything like that. I didn't know. I was new to L.A. So I learned what a director does and what a producer does and what a casting agent is and what a grip is and a lighting person. So you sit back and you learn and you watch and you learn how to behave on set, you know. So, you know, the jargon. So being an extra was like a sponge. Then when I was a PA, same thing. I learned the writing process. I learned what writers do and sitting in the writer's room or directors. And then it's TV and film is totally different and different titles and different jobs or same titles, different jobs and the different genres. So, yeah, man.
So that was another question I had for you. For you know, you're a comedian, and then when you do movies and you transition into acting, how is it working with great actors and then opposite with working with comedians?
As far as like working with comedians in a production or doing a comedy show,
like in a film or something. Like for example, Rob Schneider's a stand up as well. So is you. He? Well, yeah. I mean, he did stand up. He still does.
Really?
Yeah. Not the biggest Rob Schneider fan.
Huh. The little guy. The little guy?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Okay.
Bad history there? I don't know.
You know what I said? I'm gonna get rid of all my grudges in 2020. But since it's 2019. I'm not getting rid of that grudge yet. Yeah. No, that was interesting with that one.
Yeah.
That production. Because, you know, I came from productions where they allowed me to go. They allowed me to have the green light.
Right.
You know, a sitcom called Good News, which is on UPN. And one of the greatest TV producers of all time, Ed Weinberger, who created Taxi, Mary Tyler Moore, Cosby Show, Sparks, and the show I was on, Amen. And he gave me the green light. You know, I came off of a movie on American History X, acting opposite Ed Norton, where director Tony Kaye, first day on the set, said, "You have the green light. You know, do you. I trust you." I came off of shooting a movie called Life, which starred Eddie Murphy, Martin Lawrence, Bernie Mac.
I probably should have said those names first when I said stand-up.
You went to the bottom. shit, not even the bottom. But, so when Eddie Murphy told the director first day on the set, let them go.
Yeah.
And then I get on the animal and I was handcuffed, you know, really couldn't, wasn't much for ad-libbing and just not bringing me to what I could have brought to that role.
Yeah.
And it was like, wow. And everybody knew it. Everybody around knew it. And it was not an enjoyable experience. It's to the point I came and watched the movie.
Oh, really?
To be honest.
Well, I'm so sorry because, like, honestly, that's one of my favorite films.
Really? I'm sorry to steal your joy. Yeah. Anybody else's, I didn't want to steal your joy, but, you know.
I thought you were hysterical on that.
Really? Man, you have a low bar for.
My favorite scene is when you're talking about what it's like being black at an airport. And then he's like, "Oh, Rob Schneider's like, because you're black." And then you're like, "Hell no, because that's stupid. You guys stupid."
That some bitch is dumb. So it was challenging because my creativity wasn't allowed to be, wasn't accepted.
Right.
And just to say, it wasn't a director. Let's just put it that way.
Okay.
So, yeah, so it's like it was tough. It was really tough for being trusted by so many greats, and then someone kind of handcuffs you.
Yeah, I can see how that
because it wasn't fun.
It kills your freedom as an artist, too.
And as a comedian, I mean, that's, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Especially since another stand-up brother, you know, like he should,
Well.
Yeah, but I mean, he should, like, respect that, you know. Yeah.
You know, unless you're insecure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true, too. I mean. Yeah.
People know me. I have no filter. I spit facts. I don't false cues and, you know, I ruffle feathers. And if people get offended, then that's on you. Get therapy.
I have no filter, too. I actually, you know, since you kind of, I'll tell you, I put in a job to open up for Rob, and his representative has said no because I talk about having autism too much. And I guess Rob doesn't believe in autism.
But if you'd have promised to take him to Whole Foods in every city, maybe he would have, you know, let you open up for him.
But so, like, I understand the hurt, you know what I mean, of that type of thing.
Yeah.
Tell me what's funny and what's not.
Right.
You know, so.
Right.
But
that's your story, yeah. Right? Is autism your story?
Yeah.
And that's your story. Why not? And that's what I was saying about being a comic and a comedian. A comic will say funny things. A comedian make things funny. Autism is your story. You're telling your story.
Yeah. So.
You know, and I get it. I mean, that's the autism. I mean, to each his own and not sound like a hypocrite, the headliner has a right to choose what material they want to come in front of them. I don't like somebody really dirty in front of me.
Yeah.
You know? And if that's their story, that's their story, but it's my choice. So in his defense, if he has, you know, if he maybe he feels that it sets a different mood for the audience or whatever. I don't know. So, I mean, this is right, but at the same time, it's your story. Keep telling your story. And if someone doesn't want you to do that in front of them, then you just keep moving on to someone who will.
Yeah. I think doors happen with every, like, rejection. So, like,
absolutely.
With that rejection, I got Jay Moore. You know what I mean?
Exactly. So you got a comedian.
You know, so it's like, because I can't be with Norm forever. And then right. I was with Hotz. And then, you know.
Jeremy Hotz?
I love Jeremy.
Yeah.
Like.
The Canadian?
Yeah. Like, I like the Canadian guys.
Yeah.
And it's weird because I'm Texan. You know? So it's
you
like
you, that means you don't like blacks then.
No, I love but
I'll fuck with you.
No, another question I had for you is like in this day of age with comedy, because I saw you at the Laugh Factory, you were going against Trump and it was funny, but like how does that like change with, you know, your way of thinking, you know what I mean?
What do you mean?
Like, if there's a whole room full of Trump supporters.
They always come to my shows.
Yeah. And you
they come to my shows all the time.
And you just keep going with
it. Yeah. Why? Facts.
Yeah.
And they don't like facts.
Yeah.
So, no, I don't bite my tongue. I don't trump my Trump material because they're in the room. I've had some walk out, you know, some old white men walk out and with their old white wives walk out because it's true. And the thing about it is I talk about everybody.
Yeah.
It's not just Trump. I talk about Obama.
Yeah.
I talk about Hillary. I talk about Trump. I spread the shit around.
Yeah.
But they are too locked into their guy that they can't, you know, they can't. And it's comedy.
Yeah.
It's comedy. It's that joke is literally maybe 3 minutes, 4 minutes out of, and when I'm doing a normal set, hour and 15 minutes, and you can't, for 3 minutes, that bugs you. That's guilt.
That's true.
That's what that is. It's guilt, and it's my opinion.
Yeah.
So you know, I spread it around pretty evenly. So yeah. I don't care. I mean, I play Ohio a lot, and I love Ohio. It's my favorite state because it's like, you know, it's a good litmus test for your material.
Right.
You know, so you won't be too inside or too, you know, one way. If they're laughing in Ohio, then they're laughing anywhere. That's why it's one of the swing states. You know, when it comes to the election, because it's a very important state. So, but I, you know, I do it purposely in those audiences in those states.
So
I put it up front.
So
they let you know right up front, you know, this is my balls are going in your face up front.
So you would say Ohio is the state to go to really get good.
To really test out material. Yeah. I think New York, honestly, is probably the best place for stand-up.
Yeah, because you could go like eight times a night.
Eight times a night. You can make more money than you do in L.A. doing stand-up. But it's just that grind, it's that grit. And New Yorkers don't laugh at just anything. New Yorkers, you got to put in that work. You got to put in that. You got to bring it.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, if you go to the black shows, I mean, I've seen Showtime at the Apollo. I've seen them. They booed a gospel out group one time. Like, how you boo Jesus? That's pretty damn rough.
They really booed Jesus.
They booed a gospel group. And the Lord booed. Like, y'all going to hell. This whole audience going to hell. All y'all burning. I got Jesus jokes, but I ain't going to boo Jesus. I may boo Jesus up.
Yeah.
Pause. But
I heard you did a theater for through a white supreme hate group. Is that true?
Oh, years ago. It wasn't on, but I didn't know I was doing it. I was in Vegas. It's like, it was probably like 99.
Yeah.
1999. I was doing a show in Vegas and a white supremacist group came to my show. and I'm like, okay, they must have saw American History X and thought, you know, I was Ed Norton. But it was crazy because it was after a hanging they had done in Texas, I think it was Tyler, Texas. Mm-hmm. There's a guy, Donald Byrd, got drugged by the back of a pickup truck in Texas. It was around that time, and I was just doing some material. And the guys were real fun at first, and then it turned. It turned very quickly.
Yeah.
And I had, but it was the beginning of the show, so I didn't. I still had, you know, 30 minutes to do, and I was like, damn, I can't, you know, start a fucking race riot in the club. So I just, I was smart, and I said, you know what, to the group, because it was more than just, you know, the white supremacist group in there. Some other white people in there, some real white people in there. I mean, they're all real, but the supremacist group were crackers. And there was some other white people in there that I call white people. See, you're considered white. I considered the supremacist groups crackers. So it's the crackers who were ruining it, and the white people were cool.
Yeah.
Right? So I just started saying, you know what? I applaud, you know, these crackers for showing their hatred, because there's a lot of closet, you know, racists out there. At least I know who hates me.
Yeah.
I said, but hate is a sin, and when you die, you're gonna burn up. You're gonna die and go to hell and burn up and turn into what you really don't like anyway, darkies. So that's how I got out of it, and I went on with the rest of my show, and the white people love how I handled it. The crackers didn't like it. But the white people love how I handled it, because they were like, man, thank you. You know, we apologize for them, and you're a professional. Yeah, because I, at the end of the day, you have a show to do.
Yeah.
And you can't let a few bad apples spoil the whole damn show.
Yeah. But did that, did it make you, like, once you realized what it was, like, holy Lord, like, why did I take this gig?
No, it was a Riviera.
Oh, was it?
It's a casino.
Oh.
So you can't control who comes in and out of there, really.
Yeah.
So it was like, it was one of those weeks where you're doing 16 shows in like 5 days.
Yeah.
Like 3 shows a day. Bye. So it was just one of the shows.
I thought it was kind of like in Death to Smoochie, where Edward Norton goes to play, you know, for a church, and then they turn on the lights on the Nazis.
Right. Funny you say that. Funny you say that, Death to Smoochie, because I was in, when they were shooting that in Canada, I was shooting a movie called Don't Say a Word.
Okay.
Which was Brittany Murphy, Famke Janssen, Michael Douglas, and their stages were right next to our stages.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so Ed Norton and Robin Williams and Danny DeVito would come over and hang out, and they don't hang out with me. They're hanging out with, you know, Michael Douglas, of course.
Yeah.
I'm sure Catherine Zeta-Jones is on the set sometimes, too. They want to see her fine ass. But yeah, so it was funny you said that movie. Yeah, but yeah, I remember that scene.
Yeah. Death to Smoochie is one of my, like, guilty pleasures. Like,
you like weird movies.
I do. You're
weird. You look like a weird fuck. So,
well, this is also going to, like, shock you. They call me the John Cusack of stand-up comedy because I just say anything.
John Cusack's a pretty cool guy, man.
Yeah, you worked with him. That was, like, how I was going to end it. But what was it like working with John Cusack?
It was fun, man. John was real easy. It's, aside from being a Cubs fan that he is, that's the only terrible thing about him. Yeah. But real, man, real, he's just, he acts with such ease, so effortless, you know. And but Jeremy Piven was in that movie as well.
Oh, I love Stand Up Now. Yeah.
Justin Hoffman,
yeah.
Gene Hackman, those two were just, man, unbelievably great. I mean, Justin Hoffman was just such a class act, man.
Yeah,
man. And it was fun production.
Yeah,
really fun production.
When you work with all these great actors, like, do you, when you work with them, do you think, oh man, this is what I gotta take? Like, you learn some of their skill.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's cool to steal in acting. It's not cool to steal in comedy.
Yeah.
You know, it's not cool to steal material in comedy. Yeah. You can be inspired by some of your greats, stand up. But in acting, of course. I mean, I've learned on almost every production I've been on. I've learned something from Ed Norton. You know, was a phenomenal actor. Learned a lot from working with him. I remember doing a role in an HBO movie called Introducing Dorothy Dandridge, and Halle Berry played Dorothy Dandridge.
Wow!
And I learned from her. She was such a professional.
Yeah.
And
she's gorgeous.
She's gorgeous. She's fine. Fine as frog hair.
Yeah.
But yeah, she was. I learned from her. I learned from everybody I've worked with: Eddie Murphy, Martin Lawrence, Bernie Mac. I mean,
John Cusack.
No, actually, really. Yeah. I mean, just really, really phenomenal actors, and I've been blessed.
Yeah. Of all the actors you worked with, who do you think has the, like, if they wanted to be a stand-up, who has that skill?
I'm not surprised Jeremy Piven is doing stand-up. He probably should have done it long ago because he's, you know, I think he has those chops. Who's not a stand-up? Hell. Everybody I've worked with, let's see. I couldn't see anybody else really. Maybe Luis Guzman.
Yeah.
You know, we did the movie Runaway Jury together, and Luis Guzman, you know, Count of Monte Cristo, he could do it if he wanted to. He could pull it off.
You don't think Cusack could?
I don't know.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see Cusack. I think he's such a good actor that if you wrote his jokes for him and put it in a script for him, he'd be able to pull it off. But I don't know if he could just be a raw, straight up stand-up.
Yeah. Well, I met him last year. This story is going to like make you laugh. There's a point to it, I swear.
Okay.
But he goes on tour and he plays one of his films and he takes money for the films he does and he does a Q&A after. That's the light for the buzzer. And
give me the light, y'all. Time to get off stage.
So I went because I'm like, honestly, like, he's my hero. Mm-hmm. You know, like when I write scripts, I write with John Cusack in mind.
That's not a bad thing.
Yeah. And so I went there to the Fox Theater. I tweeted kind of like how I tweeted you. I over-tweeted so my questions could get into the machine.
Right.
So, like, all these questions are coming up, you know, from Keith Reza and John Cusack. It is like he's on mic and he doesn't know. He's like, man, that Keith Reza has a lot of fucking questions. It's hilarious, right? And then I won the whole VIP meet John question, like only five people.
Right.
So I won that with all the questions, and then I asked him, and I told him the Say Anything joke. He laughed, and I asked him a question. And then the lady behind me, she acted like a bigger fan than me, and she asked the stupidest question. She's like, John, how come in every single movie you're on the phone? And John's like, I'm not on the phone in every single movie. She's like, no, I stalk you. I watch all your movies. You're on the phone. And he's like, did you ever see The Jack Bull? And she's like, yeah. He's like, that's a Western. The whole audience just laughed like so hard. It was the funniest.
That's funny.
Thing.
That is funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does have that sense of humor.
Yeah.
It would be. It'd be interesting.
Yeah. Oh, man.
It'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Because he's more of a smart ass, but that's how I started.
Yeah. That's how I think a lot of comics do.
And then get into comedy. That's funny, though. Yeah.
I started doing comedy because I always got picked on in school. So, like, I was like.
You got bullied, man?
Hardcore.
Fuckers.
Yeah. But I went to an open mic and I figured, like, all these people are laughing at me when they're, like, hitting me. Maybe I'm funny. So that's why, like, I started doing comedy.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah. And I was very nonverbal with my autism. So, like, you know, the jokes were, you know, because I still have a stutter sometimes. But, like. Uh-huh. I've been doing comedy for so long, like, I've learned how to talk and I've gone to speeches.
So what's your point of view on autism? Like, what
like,
are you...
Like, vaccines and stuff? Or
no, what's your point of view? When you're on stage, what are you trying to get the people to know about you and autism through comedy?
That people with autism can make their dreams come true and not just talk about it.
Right.
You know, because in my support groups growing up, you know, they were like, oh, I want to be a writer and all that stuff, and then they just stay at home. I'm still at home, but at least I'm doing comedy.
Right.
You know, so, like, that's what my point is, showing the
greatness of it. So does autistic children get bullied a lot?
I did. I mean, I don't know if everyone does, but I
but in support groups, so, like, you had support groups.
Yeah, we had autism support
groups. So was that a common theme or a common problem?
That's
crazy.
You know, it was very sad because, like, I was, you know, with this group, and then I went to several groups, you know, so.
So stand-up, you said, you know what, I'm going to do stand-up, I'm going to do comedy.
Yeah, and I did an open mic, and they had this thing at this mom-and-pop's coffee shop.
Right.
And they said $100 for the funniest joke, and I told the joke, and I won $100.
Wow.
You know.
And then that was it. Then you got bit, and that's what happens.
Yeah.
You get that first laugh, and you get bit, and it's like, boom.
But I know it's like the first time you do it, you do great, and then you do terrible for 10 years, then you do good again. You know?
Well, you know, my first official time, I did great for the first 3 minutes, and then I went to my material. I was like freestyle, and I went to my material and died a death of 1,000 dogs. And then, so it was kind of like bittersweet the first time.
Yeah.
You know? But I went up the next night and did a little bit better. And then just, you know, you just stick with this shit.
Yeah, that's I mean, I've been doing it. I mean, I'm not a headliner. I would say I would.
You're a headliner. You're just not selling enough tickets yet.
Yeah. How
long you been doing it?
16 years.
How much time do you have? Solid time?
Solid time, 45.
You're a headliner. Yeah. Solid, funny time.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just need to put more, just need to sell more tickets.
Yeah. And then, but like, I don't do crowd work. Like, crowd work, I have a thing with crowd work with, is like, if someone like is heckling me or whatever, I just say, you're going to win. I'm going to move on to the, you know what I mean?
He's just very honest, okay? All right. Let me stick to my program. Hecklers don't want to see me, man.
Yeah, I say, I'm. Listen, I'm the John Cusack of stand-up. Right now, I feel I'm better off dead.
You got to work those titles in. Yeah. Work those references.
But like, I like twisting stuff. Like, right. Growing up, kids would make paper airplanes, and I would make paper airports.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
So. I like that. See, so I see how your mind works.
Yeah.
Which is, okay.
And, you know, you've only known me for 30 minutes. So, like, that's the point I try, because I have a feeling you love me now. You know what I mean?
I ain't love you. I ain't going to be booed up.
Yeah, but, yeah.
You know.
But, you know.
I like you more than I did when I first walked in.
Exactly. Yeah. So like that's the point of my comedy,
right?
You know, what I mean?
And you know what? That's a very good. That's a very key point.
Yeah,
that's very very poignant because that's what we want. If someone doesn't know us when, because some people they get comp tickets, they may come with a friend. They have no idea who Guy Tori is. They have no idea who they're seeing. And it's a free ticket, and they come. And then my job is to, man, I hope it's to get you to like me a little bit more. Perfect. Now than when you first walked in and sat down. If you weren't a fan then, my goal is to make you a fan.
Yeah, that's powerful too.
Yeah, it's powerful and it's addictive.
Yeah,
see, but that should be our goal. Our goal shouldn't be to offend.
No, not
our
at
goal.
All.
Somebody's gonna get offended.
Yeah,
because I'm very offensive. But that shouldn't be our goal. Our goal should be is to make you laugh and make you take your mind off your problems while you're in there for. However many, an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever. That's our goal is to make you laugh, entertain you, and allow you to take a piece of us home with you.
Nah.
That's our goal.
So the last question I have for you is if you could take back time and redo one thing in your career, that knowing what you know now, what would you do?
I would have, I tell you what I would have done. I would have told my story sooner.
Yeah.
When I first started doing stand-up, my brother was already in the stand-up, and he was already talking about the family and stuff like that. And I wanted to make myself so different from my brother, so I started being more observational and talking more about politics. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, oh, not that I'm, you never run out of material, but I'm like, man, no one really knows my story.
Yeah.
And that's how people latch on to you. That's how people follow you. That's how they fuck with you, when they know your story. And I wish I would have told my story sooner. I'm telling it now, but I wish I would have told it sooner.
Yeah. So, and that would have, you think that would have made you a stronger comic when you were younger?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It would have definitely increased my fan base. It would have made people care sooner.
Yeah. Well, I care for you and I love you very much.
Well, thank you, man. I love you back.
Thank you so much for doing this. It meant a lot,
man. Thanks for having me, brother.
Yeah. And thanks to your cousin.
My nephew is. He's a professional soccer player. Okay. He's on break right now.
Oh, professional soccer player?
Yeah, he played over in Estonia, right outside of Russia.
That's awesome.
Player of the year, right? Player of the year. First season.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's...
Yes, yes. Chilling. Eric McWoods. Look out for him. Eric McWoods.
What number are you?
Nine.
Nine?
Number nine.
That's a good number.
Yeah.
Are you a Laker fan?
Huge.
Yeah. Who's your favorite Laker of all time?
Magic Johnson.
Magic Johnson?
Yeah.
All right.
Because he's the reason why I started rooting for the Lakers.
Yeah.
I was 10, and I started watching him at Michigan State, and then when he went to the Lakers, like, that's my team.
You're going to laugh at my answer.
Who's your answer?
Eddie Jones.
I like Eddie Jones. I like Eddie Jones. I knew Eddie Jones. Yeah. I know Eddie Jones. I knew him when he was there. I know Eddie Jones. Yeah. Real cool. Yeah, he and Kobe was almost like the same player. I think that's why.
Yeah,
they chose. You know, they got rid of him. But I loved him as a Laker, man.
They
went to the Heat after that.
He went to the Hornets Then
the Heat. There you go. Yeah, Hornets, then the Heat. Yeah.
He was traded on March 10th, 1999, which was a Wednesday. I know that because that was the day I was diagnosed with autism.
Wow.
And I was crying because we had Laker tickets for Christmas that my dad, my family's very poor. So my dad got me Laker tickets.
Wow.
For April. And Eddie Jones was my favorite player, and I'm crying. And then my dad's like, oh, it's just autism. I was like, no, the Lakers trade Eddie Jones. It was so, you know.
I mean, I'm laughing at this. That's funny. I was like,
but for a 13-year-old, that's devastating.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, and then you have to wait 2 years because he goes to fucking Miami. Right. And they only play once.
I actually ran into him in Miami. I was in playing a gig. I was playing the improv in Miami.
Yeah.
In Coconut Grove. And he was, it was another guy. I think it was Ike Austin was staying in a hotel as well.
Yeah.
And Eddie Jones was coming to pick him up because they were going to go work out.
Yeah.
And I ran into him like, yo, man. But I know he used to come to Fat Tuesdays all the time at the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
So I knew a lot of Lakers players from there.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I'm glad you liked Eddie Jones.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I loved Eddie Jones, man. He was a great player, man.
All right, where can the folks follow you?
Follow me on my Instagram, at Guy Torrey. Please follow me. If you're listening to this, don't just turn it off. Go follow me, at Guy Torrey, GUY2RRY. Also on Twitter. I'm stepping up my social media game in 2020, but I'm starting now. So, you know, follow me. I'm having my YouTube page be up soon. That's Guy Torrey. I'm doing a lot of content now.
Yeah.
That's being edited right now. To start my YouTube page. To put some decent content on it.
And then I'm gonna sell a movie and get you in it. It's gonna be a huge.
That's
hit.
Right. That's right.
And then you're gonna make some calls to John Cusack.
Yeah.
And we'll get him.
It's funny
in the
you
sequel.
Say that because I have a friend of the family. She worked in the hotel business, but. She was a huge, she's still a huge John Cusack fan.
Oh, yeah.
Her name is Kim Graves. And when I was doing Runaway Jury, she's like, it was a birthday. She said, do me a favor. Can you please have John Cusack say happy birthday to me?
Oh,
I said, okay. So what I did was I got a big piece of white poster board and I put, hi, Kim Graves. And I had John Cusack holding it. And I took the picture. So every time on her birthday, I'll post that picture. For
that's the sweetest thing ever.
Yeah.
And that's cool because both of you did it.
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah.
So you're my new John Cusack. Follow Guy Torrey, guys. And if you like the show, subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes and Apple Podcasts. Alan Lee wasn't here because he sucks.
He sucks. He does. I saw him. I filmed it. I got blackmail film on him sucking.
We love you, Alan, guys. Thank you guys so much.
You're listening to Razor Riffs with Keith Razor and Alan Lee right here on LA Talk Radio.